This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour, Iran begins 10-day celebrations marking the anniversary of the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. British teachers, civil servants, train drivers, and university lecturers take part in the largest coordinated industrial action in years. Also in the headlines, activist groups say executions in Saudi Arabia have nearly doubled in recent years as they detail cases of torture and unfair trials in the kingdom.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mews. Thanks for joining us.
Iran has begun the 10-day Fajr or dawn ceremonies, marking the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Festivities start from February the 1st, the day when the founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, returned to Iran from France after 15 years in exile. His arrival intensified protests against the U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime, and 10 days later ended in the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The 1979 Islamic Revolution, led by Imam Khomeini, established a new political system based on Islamic values and democracy. Each year, millions of Iranians take to the streets to attend the festivities, also known as the Dahe-e Fajr. Iran condemns the flare-up of Israeli violence against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Tehran says the Tel Aviv regime is doomed to decay and disintegrate. The foreign ministry spokesman says the Israeli regime, mired in domestic crises, is facing the Palestinian resistance in the West Bank, the besieged Gaza Strip, and the 1948 Israeli-occupied territories. Nasser Kanani said that Israel's atrocities against Palestinians cannot save the regime from falling into decline. Tel Aviv has recently stepped up violence and a crackdown against Palestinians. 10 Palestinians were killed last week in the regime's single deadliest raid in the occupied West Bank in years. The bloody raid drew condemnations from the Palestinian Authority and resistance groups. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has met with Iranian manufacturers. The meeting is aimed at solving challenges facing the country's domestic production. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Over 600 business owners, producers, and entrepreneurs active in different sectors were invited to a special place, the office of the leader of the Islamic Revolution. The aim is to share their concerns and highlight the major challenges they face in their businesses, with leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, listening carefully and taking notes.
Your Highness, you instructed us on how to solve the production problems during the economic war. The 13th administration proposed a bill on planting 1 billion trees in 4 years. It's a very good initiative that can serve our agriculture sector, but we need to implement it in a shorter time.
We need to ensure maximum purchase from local producers and stop uncontrolled and illegal import of commodities that can be produced domestically.
Ayatollah Khamenei said he understands the producers' concerns, calling on the officials present at the meeting to address the challenges manufacturers are grappling with. Iran's leader says despite the imposition of extensive sanctions against Iran, the country has managed to keep its economic growth up and running and has taken effective steps towards indigenizing different economic sectors. However, Ayatollah Khamenei says this is not enough. He called on both producers and officials to continue to develop the economy and compensate the existing shortcomings in some areas. Entrepreneurs and producers here believe meeting the leader of the Islamic Revolution means a lot, since his instructions will push the government to take more serious steps to address production obstacles.
I believe such meetings will inspire and motivate us producers and entrepreneurs who have concerns about their businesses. Here, we got to know how much our leader cares about what we do when he listens to our demands and orders the authorities to meet our needs.
It's a chance to highlight the major hurdles that stand in the way of industrialists and find solutions to them. The leader's instructions will definitely provide a roadmap for the executive authorities to take action and remove the challenges.
The meeting came 2 days after Ayatollah Khamenei paid a three-hour visit to an exhibition showcasing Iran's capabilities in domestic production. The expo brought together top local manufacturers to present their latest products and services in a range of industries, including oil and petrochemical sectors, IT, aerospace, urban development, and agriculture.
Basically, such meetings with Iran's leader will not end without a significant output, especially when it comes to domestic production, as Ayatollah Khamenei has on different occasions stressed the need to support local manufacturers. This is because he views science-based production as a key to a resilient economy and a powerful counterforce to U.S. sanctions. Yusuf Jalali from the official residence of Iran's leader in Tehran.
Britain is hit with more industrial action over a long-running pay dispute between workers and the governments. Now teachers and train drivers have staged nationwide strikes to press for their demand. According to the Trades Union Congress, about 500,000 workers are taking part, making it the biggest strike action in more than a decade. Over 85% of schools in England and in Wales would remain closed on Wednesday. Commuter chaos has been anticipated as 15 train operators have planned zero train services. Workers are angry over the rampant inflation that has outpaced their earnings. They're demanding an increase in their wages in line with inflation. Most public sector workers, ranging from healthcare to railways, energy and education, have staged mass walkouts since last summer, causing widespread disruptions across the UK. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. West groups say executions in Saudi Arabia have nearly doubled under the rule of King Salman and his son, the de facto ruler Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. According to a report by Rapiv and the European Saudi Organization for Human Rights, the average of executions has increased to almost 130 a year since King Salman rose to the throne in 2015. Over 1,000 death sentences have been carried out since then. According to rights groups, those executed include protesters and children. The report also details cases of torture and unfair trials. Rights groups have slammed MBS for overseeing a harsh crackdown on critics. The Western allies of Saudi Arabia are also accused of turning a blind eye to the kingdom's human rights record in favor of their own interests. Simon Sinabas, journalist and political commentator, joins us from London. Faisal Najim is the manager at the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, who joins us from Toronto. Welcome to you both. Simon Sinabas, first over to you. The executions in Saudi Arabia has been going on for quite some time. But the fact that since the Crown Prince has come to power and the executions have increased, what does that say about how he feels about his critics in particular?
Well, since Bin Salman has been in power, clearly there has been a difference in the way Saudi Arabia's actual establishment has operated. He's essentially done a power grab. I mean, he wasn't in line naturally to take over. That's not the way the Saudi establishment works. The son doesn't necessarily take over from the king. It can often be the brother or the cousin. That's the way it was. But it's a fact that Bin Salman has been back by the Zionists to be their man, the one who is going to take them into the rest of the 21st century. And one of his first acts was the most heinous crime of launching a war on Yemen. And we all know that the amount of human rights violations that have gone on there. But internally, he started as he meant to go on. He incarcerated most of his relatives in a very expensive hotel, albeit. Sheikh Salman al-Auda is one such individual accused of being part of the Muslim Brotherhood. Hassan Farhan al-Maliki is another one I can name. Wahid Abul Khair, who simply criticized on media the human rights injustices of the Saudis and got given 15 years in jail. Of course, the failure of the Saudis to stop their war on Yemen, to stop all these 30,000 plus prisoners of conscience, which are locked up in Saudi jails without due process without real courts has not stopped. It's increased, and it's no doubt the Western powers are egging him on and giving him carte blanche to do this.
Well, that's the other aspect of this first, Al-Najim. When you have the Western powers who are not even in a sense condemning what Saudi Arabia is doing, I mean, we've seen how they have reacted when it comes to the Saudi regime, even when there's proof that in the case of Jamal Khashoggi, that wasn't an execution. There was proof there, and yet Saudis were brought back into the fold. What are the interests of the West for not going after Saudi Arabia the way that it should, for a regime that has executed so many people?
I mean, it's very shameful for the West to continue Saudi regime, but at the end of the day, they really care about their benefits and their interests, and that is to control West Asia, as they call it, Middle East, and the resources, and to have certain puppet regimes, and to secure the Zionist regime. This is the main goal of the U.S. and the British and the French and their allies. And unfortunately, they preach about human rights, they preach about international law, and all these type of things that they, as if they're fighting for justice, but then they support the most unjust systems and a tribal regime. A tribal regime. It has nothing to do with democracy, what they promote and what they try to have established. And the Saudi regime is totally against speaks out. If in the smallest way, on so they're arrested and they're suppressed, and sometimes they're shot. Sometimes they can't even talk to their family. Sometimes they can't even have a lawyer to represent them. They don't even have sometimes a funeral, like Sheikh Nimr, for instance. When they killed him, they didn't even give him a place of burial and a funeral where people can even visit him. So this is the type of repressive, despotic type of regime the Saudi regime is. And it's always been arresting females, been arresting youth, very young youth, in especially in the Eastern province. I'm working right now on a particular case with Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, a person by the name of Hassan Mohammed Al-Rabia. This person, it's a pretty much a blackmail kind of case. So if they are looking for somebody that has opposed them or protested against them or opposed their foreign policies or whatever it is inside the country, so what they do is if that person escaped to another country, they'll try to arrest somebody inside the country that is family members or relatives. So this person right now, all of a sudden they put in a warrant for his arrest, and he had to he tried to run away to Morocco, and now he's we're in the process to try to put pressure on Morocco not to extradite him back to Saudi Arabia, because many of his brothers have been arrested as well. He's got a brother right now that's facing execution in Saudi Arabia. Two brothers that have escaped Saudi Arabia and lived somewhere in West Asia, and then now one of them is in Morocco we're trying to see if we can help not get him extradited back to Saudi Arabia. These people are innocent people. They just protested, pretty much, some of them. And some of them didn't even protest. They just wanted to somehow put pressure. And this is the Saudi regime that you're dealing with.
Okay, thank you for that. Saim Hossein Abbas, journalist and political commentator. First, Al-Najim, manager of the Canadian Defender for Human Rights from Toronto. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in. Russia says it wants to preserve the New START nuclear treaty despite Washington's destructive approach to arms control. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says the continuation of the treaty is very important to Moscow. He believes that it is necessary to keep at least some hints of continued dialogue with Washington. The U.S. has accused Russia of violating the treaty by banning the entry of inspectors into its territory. The New START came into force in 2011 and got extended for 5 more years in 2021. Under the treaty, the U.S. and Russia have agreed to put a cap on the number of nuclear warheads in their arsenals. Around 90% of the world's nuclear warheads belong to Russia and the U.S. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has stressed the importance of cooperation between the alliance and its partners in the Indo-Pacific, saying the region's security matters to the military organization.
We agree that transatlantic and Indo-Pacific security is deeply interconnected. What happens in this region matters to NATO, and what happens in Europe matters to you. President Putin wins.
Stoltenberg made the comments during a visit to Japan on Wednesday. He hailed Japan's plan to double its defense budget as a sign of the country's resolve for greater security involvement. The NATO chief also pledged to strengthen ties with Tokyo to navigate what he called an increasingly tense security environment triggered by Russia's war and its growing military cooperation with China. Stoltenberg also warned against China's military buildup.
Beijing is substantially building up its military forces, including nuclear weapons, without any transparency. It is attempting to assert control over the South China Sea and threatening Taiwan, trying to take control of critical infrastructure, including in NATO countries.
Stoltenberg added that Beijing is also deepening its strategic partnership with Moscow. He said that Japan and NATO must remain united and firm in the face of the security threats posed by China, Russia, and North Korea. Stoltenberg said, however, that China is not an adversary, and NATO will engage with the country on areas of potential common interest. The NATO chief is on a trip to Asia aimed at boosting ties with allies. Before his stop in Japan, Stoltenberg paid a visit to South Korea, where he urged Seoul to increase military support for Ukraine. Cold winter goes on, and children in Afghanistan are the largest segment affected by the season and the situation. Reports confirm that there is a 55% rise in the number of patients under the age of five. Poverty, unemployment, and political instability are adding to the dire condition that mainly affects children's health.
The humanitarian situation in Afghanistan is alarming. Millions are in dire need of humanitarian assistance and medical aid, especially children. Pneumonia and malnutrition are rife, particularly among children. The International Committee of Red Cross says there is a 55% rise in the number of patients under the age of 5 in 2022. Health experts say the situation is probably going to get even worse.
We must be ready for more incidents before they happen. Lack of food and medicine for children is a concern, especially after the recent developments in Afghanistan. Also, some international organizations have mixed politics with health now and reduced or cut their support. This negatively affects the needy patients.
One of the main reasons for the alarming trend is the economic crisis in the country that has deteriorated the living conditions of Afghans.
Of course, economic problems are involved in malnutrition of these children. When we tell the parents to feed babies with formula 8 times a day, they simply don't, because they don't have the money for it.
Since U.S.-backed forces withdrew from Afghanistan in 2021, foreign aid has declined dramatically and key central bank assets have been seized by the U.S. government, compounding one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. Afghan officials have time and again called on the West to stop politicizing humanitarian aid to the country.
Afghanistan has a population of almost 30 million, all of whom need medical care and services. In this regard, there are international aid organizations that have cooperation with us and work in Afghanistan, and there are ones that suspended their missions. Humanitarian aid in Afghanistan should not be politicized.
Despite working tirelessly and with great devotion, healthcare workers say quick measures should be taken in order to prevent a health crisis in Afghanistan. They say the cold season and high unemployment rates add to the number of malnourished children. Decades of war, natural disasters, poverty, and food insecurity. These are factors that have contributed to the making of the current humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. The country's population is in dire need of humanitarian aid and therefore is calling on the international community to stop what they see as politicizing the issue. Abdullah Mirzadeh, Kabul.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ولایت فقیه in victory of Islamic revolution. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, these days mark the 44th anniversary of victory of the Islamic revolution in Iran. We are with you with the second episode of the special series on this occasion. In this episode, we are going to dwell upon the role of velayat-e-faqih, or God-given authority of supreme jurisprudence, in the triumph of the Islamic revolution. Stay with us, please. Human history is replete with wars and conflicts among various people due to the clash of their interests and differences of beliefs. According to the Quran, these conflicts will continue till the absolute victory of truth over falsehood. This battle of truth and falsehood has been affected by various powers in different eras. No doubt, power is originated in the leadership of every community. Victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979 totally changed the meaning of leadership and concept of power. This change was mainly in the form of a superior power shaped with the bond of leader and people. Basically, the top achievement of victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution was the establishment of the Islamic system of government on the basis of the theory of velayat-e-faqih. Velayat-e-faqih, or God-given authority of the supreme jurisprudence, was not only pivotal in the triumph of the Islamic revolution, it has also played a unique role in going through innumerable crises and overcoming unprecedented conspiracies, each of which could annihilate any system and country. As per the Shia school of thought, in addition to the principles of monotheism, prophethood, and the hereafter, a believer should believe in two other principles of divine justice and imamat, or leadership of the infallible successors of the Prophet of Islam. However, during the era of occultation of Imam Mahdi, as the 12th and last infallible successor, the most qualified person to hold the hems of power among Muslims is the supreme jurisprudent who possesses special qualities. The eternity and comprehensiveness of the Islamic laws require the existence of government even during the era of occultation, that is, the age when the 12th Imam is not accessible to the public due to the divine will. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, describes ulema as his vicegerents and the heirs of all prophets, and Imam Ali, peace upon him, calls them as the rulers of people. He says in a hadith, according to the edict of God and Islam on Muslims, it is obligatory that they do not do anything unless they choose a pious and God-weary leader who is aware of judicial laws and the practice of God's messenger, so that he gathers public properties, causes people to maintain Hajj and Friday prayer, and collects alms. Therefore, choosing a qualified leader for the Islamic community has priority over every other affair. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, also stresses in a hadith, the sources and hems of affairs are in the hands of the divine scholars, the very people who are trustworthy on God's halal and haram. For your information, dear listeners, halal means whatever religion permits, and haram is whatever religion forbids. A third hadith from the Imam of Age, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, reads, as for the events, refer to the narrators of our words, because they are my vicegerents over you, and I am God's vicegerent. Here, Imam Mahdi clearly tells Muslims to follow those who have adequate knowledge of the Islamic teachings. Surely, the first group in this respect is the group of ulema. Imam Khomeini was the architect of the Islamic Revolution, who uncompromisingly fought the oppressors and defended the oppressed without an iota of fear. The Islamic Revolution triumphed when the US was the leader of the Western Bloc and the Soviet Union was the leader of the Eastern Bloc of countries. At that time, any change was feasible just with the help of and dependence on one of these powers. Yet, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, following Imam Hussein, peace upon him, as his role model, awakened the Iranian nation and caused them to rise up against a despotic and mercenary regime. Leadership enjoys the key role and position in every great event in human communities. Thus, directing and guiding any popular uprising and revolution is among the most important functions of leaders in the world. Meanwhile, one of the most important factors which materialize ideals in society is to have a monolithic ruling system which guides the masses. According to the Islamic theory, the divine leadership is like the string of rosary which links all beads together. Reviewing the role of Imam Khomeini as the person who successfully put into effect the theory of velayat-e-faqih is very important. Imam Khomeini promoted the lofty Islamic and human ideals, which people made every effort to materialize. These ideals included freedom, independence, justice, struggle against oppression, equality, and so on. For sure, the concept of velayat-e-faqih existed for centuries among Muslims, but it was Imam Khomeini who took it out from the books and textbooks of seminaries and put it into practice, in spite of all oppositions and enmities of the front of arrogance, symbolized by the U.S. Islam is the final religion that is based on a heavenly book, the Quran. To practice the Islamic laws, there should be a system of government and leadership to preserve the Islamic Ummah against enemies. This leadership should do its best to practice justice in society. Velayat-e-Faqih is the fulcrum of the Islamic Republic system and the elements of its dynamism through decades. The role of this unique element has been evident, especially during innumerable plots that have been hatched by the sworn enemies of the Iranian nation. Ayatollah Khamenei says on the status of Velayat-e-Faqih, Velayat-e-Faqih is the position of engineering the system and preserving the line and direction of the system and preventing it from deviation, guarding and monitoring the general move of the system toward its ideal and lofty goals is the most important and fundamental role of Velayat-e-Faqih.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
A Muslim lady.
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, sisters, welcome back to a new episode of Muslim Lady. This is RIB English Radio. I am Asma and I am very happy to be at your service. Here with me, I have Sister Zainab. Welcome, sister.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you so much, Sister Asma.
And thank you for being here. And thank you, all the dear listeners, for being with us in here. Well, as the ritual of this program, we're talking about the main issues and concerns of ladies, of a Muslim lady. And who better than Lady Fatima Zahra Salamullah Alayha to go for as a role model and check her life, her behaviors, her manners, her lifestyle, and whatever aspect in her life to learn from her. We've been through her personal aspect of life, and then we got to her behavior with her parents and a lot of things actually we've been through. We've learned too much about her characteristics. And now we got to the point when she's going to pick a husband. We talked about it a bit, and of course her behavior with her husband and with her perfect patch, as we call it. So, sister, tell us a little bit more about how did she does that? Her behavior with her husband and the family.
She was asked, who are the best of the men? Then she answers, the best of the men are those who are good to their wives in terms of their ethics, in terms of their morals, in terms of their behavior. So she considers these men as the best men. Now, she does not expect this behavior only from the men. She herself has a great respect for Imam Ali alayhi salam, and she herself possesses all those good qualities and good morals that a woman should be having. We said that she was most loving. She used to call Imam Ali Islam with beautiful names, like the way...
Respect, actually, is the main issue in here.
Yeah, because we have a pretext today that if I call my husband with a very small or very some unusual name, then it's like it shows that I'm very close to him.
Yeah.
No, the more you respect a man... In fact, a prophet, peace be upon him, said that a man needs respect and a woman needs love. Women should always be careful about this thing that they should be giving respect to their husbands more than anything else, because men actually crave for that respect. So she used to call Imam Ali alayhi salam with beautiful names, like we said also in the previous episodes that she would call him Ruhi Li Ruhi Kalfeda, which means, oh, my soul, may my soul get sacrificed for you. So that's so beautiful. We don't hear such things
so
today.
Beautiful.
Or like,
so
you should call him Ya Aba al-Hassan, the father of Imam Hassan alayhi salam. But today, like, we have the same names as we have for the pets and other things.
Exactly.
So
still, we can be romantic and use those lovely words, but being so much respectful toward our
exactly. There are so many things which will, throughout the process, teach us how, and through her examples, like the way we said, like, she would call Imam Ali Islam this way. And then whenever she would see Imam Ali Islam upset or in tears, sometimes there were tears in his eyes, like, it was not always the bright day.
Exactly. It's not always pitchy.
Yeah. So, like, we would say we should not consider, like, Imam was Imam, so he was never, you know,
he would never get sad or he would never feel sorry.
There were tears in his eyes. So it was all about patience and other things. And whenever she would see tears in his eyes, she would say, she would get upset, stressed, and she would come to Imam Ali and to sympathize him and say that, may Allah never bring tears into your eyes. And that in itself shows, when you do this dua and you're sympathizing at the same time, a person feels, I have someone on my back, I can count on this person. So, but unfortunately today, ladies,
among the couples, you mean?
I have seen this. If someone has to use his words to say he is sad, you should understand he really is. See, like, let's look at our role model. She is understanding all that with the gestures, with the face expressions. She's not in need of, like, you know, words. She just sees tears and comes and consoles and sympathizes and says,
exactly,
may Allah never get tears into your eyes. This is a big lesson for us, that never wait for someone to tell you I am sad. Sometimes be a good listener. Sometimes be a good, you know, sympathizer. So sometimes be...
And sometimes just a shoulder to bear all the burdens that he has in his heart.
Yeah, we always, especially women, we kind of try to act like police. We try to ask questions or we try to give instructions. All right, you were supposed to do this so that you should have not faced this.
Exactly, which is very wrong.
Which is the worst thing in, like, if you read The Way of Life, and you, I had done one of the courses which says The Way of Life, and then in that we were talking about sympathy. The first thing we were taught was that never give instructions when you're giving sympathy. Sometimes you just need to hear, you just need to listen things.
And never say you should have never done that. That was your wrong. And after all, I guess, this is what marriage is all about, you know, friendship.
Yeah, you're actually adding to the pain when you say, all right, if you had behaved this way, you would have never faced this trouble. When you're giving instructions to other person, you're actually adding something to his pain.
You're adding
sometimes,
to the pain.
Sometimes it's not necessary to say something. We just feel like it's my duty to say something, and that's how I'll console the person. No, sometimes you have to be a better listener. That's
exactly, And that's, I guess, the main reason for marriage is to have a friend who would be always there for you. So before we get into more of... her behavior and her family, let's go for a short break, and after that we'll be back. So welcome back, dear ladies. This is your program. You're listening to IRB English Radio. I am Asma here. Sister Zainab is helping us with the lifestyle of Fatima Az-Zahra salamullah alayha, who has got a lot to share with us and teach us, actually, as the role model for every single one of us.
Then we were talking about her behavior with her husband, and we said that whenever she would see him upset or tears in his eyes, and she would come and console him, sympathize him, and say, may Allah never bring tears into your eyes. Then we also have something else, like whenever it's reported that whenever Prophet, peace be upon him, would command Imam Ali al-Islam, get ready, we have to go for a war, like, be it in the midnight, be it in the daytime, he was always ready. We have seen in so many narrations, like, Imam Ali al-Islam was always at the front line, in the frontline soldiers in his wars or whatever he had to go. When Prophet would tell him or command him and he used to get ready, she would never become a barrier.
Exactly, not
to go like,
yeah.
Because women are emotional. They would say like, I don't want to lose you. I don't want to.
You know what I would say? I would say a man is never ready unless he has a perfect woman at home.
Exactly.
To back him up.
A man reaches Mi'raj through the, you know, through her wife, like through the...
By the help of his couple, actually, his woman.
Whenever Imam Ali's son would get ready, she would, in deep down in her heart, she would feel scared. She would feel...
Of course, yes.
A little terrified because you never know. Someone is going for war. Will he come back or not? So all she could express was her tears. And whenever she would say goodbye, she would be always worried and tears would roll down her eyes. You know, when we say express your love to your partner, it never means just keep on, just count how many times you tell your partner, I love you. No, you don't have to say these three words necessarily. You can show it the other way. See, for example, isn't this I love you? Isn't this I'll miss you?
Exactly,
doesn't
yes.
these tears means, it, these tears, this silence in itself means a lot.
So are valuable,
Sometimes you just have to express it one or the other way. You don't have to just use the three words. You can use the three words the other way because sometimes the women say that, oh, I would express, but I feel shy. You don't feel shy in your actions.
Yeah.
You can show a lot of love, a lot of care through your actions. This also shows that she had different ways to show her love for Imam Ali. Sometimes she would call him with good names. Sometimes she would sympathize him. Sometimes tears would roll down her eyes. This was all expression of love.
Yeah.
So what we are saying in the attitude towards husband, we're trying to say, Muslim ladies, express your love for your husband. You know, there's one of the sayings, it's, there's one of this great man, he says that, I lost my wife and... I always used to say that I will tell her that I care for you, I love for you. Tomorrow I have enough of life. Whenever I used to come from office. But then one day she passed away.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And
there's no more of time to tell her.
And till today I regret why I never told her. So if you want to express it now.
Seize the moment.
Yeah, seize the moment. Never say to yourself that, oh, I have enough time. I have enough life. I'm
because
young.
Because nobody knows what happens in the
nobody
next
knows
turn.
Nobody knows when it's your turn, when you're going to go. So if you want to express it now. I just remember, like, as we said in the beginning of the program, I lost my grandfather. I used to often call these days my mother and tell her, like, go to him. I feel like he's not fine and you should go. And she used to say, I'll go tomorrow, today, and today. Just, you know, we just said before discussing the attitude towards husband, we discussed the attitude towards parents. Don't say, I'll go tomorrow, I'll go day after tomorrow. You never know.
Exactly.
We don't have control over time. We don't have control
and
over life.
And you know what? This is, I guess, the nature of human beings. They don't know the value of the things they love until they lose it. And after that, they know that they have a lot of words to say.
We have these narrations from Prophet, peace be upon him. Says that know the value of life before death. Know the value of health before you get sick. So we have so many things like that in the religion. So, yeah,
and I guess that's the best way to put an end to today's episode. Yeah, know the value of everything you have and you love them and cherish your moments with them, with your loved ones. Try to express your feelings as women, as these ladies who have too much of love sparkling in their heart. Try not to hide it. Show it to the people around you, specifically your husband, because, you know, if the center of a house is so warm and so happy, then you know what would happen to the rest of the family members. So this was all for today's episode. Thank you for staying with us. Until another episode, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. Allah is our
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
Allah.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, so Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The natives of Canada and the U.S. have a painful past. This truth was revealed when the mass graves of hundreds of Indigenous children who died while attending boarding schools were discovered in Canada in the summer of 2021. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Tehran Times wrote in this regard, for decades a large number of Indigenous children in Canada who were taken from their families and forced into boarding schools never returned home. An investigative team has found 66 more potential unmarked graves at a former residential school in British Columbia, the Williams Lake First Nation, WLFN, said recently at a press conference. It brings the number to 159 found at the former St. Joseph's Mission Residential School. 93 were uncovered in May 2021. Run by the Catholic Oblates Order, thousands of Indigenous children were forced to attend the mission operated between 1886 and 1981. More than 150,000 First Nations, Métis, and Inuit children were forced to attend the 139 Indian residential schools.
The first one opened around 1825 and the last closed in 1990s. The schools were funded by the Canadian government and run by the various religious denominations. Their mission was to wipe out indigenous traditions and assimilate the children into the white culture. More than 4,100 children are thought to have died in the schools, sometimes buried in mass graves, and at other times in graves that, if they were marked, became obscured over the years. More than 1,900 unmarked graves have been uncovered to date. Last year, the findings of mass graves of Indigenous children in Canada also caused an uproar in the world, and it seems that the story is still going on. Some experts and observers believe that the findings of mass graves of Indigenous children indicate dark and shameful chapter in the history of Canada, during which the Canadian government separated Indigenous children from their families to send them to the boarding schools affiliated with Catholic churches or for adoption to white families in line with the prohibition of using their mother tongue. Numerous reports of physical, emotional, and sexual abuse of these children have been released, and the available documents show that the students of these schools were exposed to the spread of mycelis, tuberculosis, influenza, and other infectious diseases, and many lost their lives. But it is clear that these chronically and intentionally underfunded institutions actually cause the high death rates among students. What is also indisputable, based on the government's own records, is that generations of federal government officials and politicians knew that the subpar conditions in the schools were killing children and chose to do nothing. According to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada, TRC, the Indian residential school system was an attempt at cultural genocide, but the escalating number of recovered unmarked graves points to something even darker. The internal conditions of the schools were unpleasant. Their buildings were poorly heated and unsanitary, and children were exposed to emotional, physical, and sexual danger. According to experts, at least 3,200 Indigenous children died while attending school, although the number is said to be likely much higher. An estimated 6,000 children die at the schools, according to the former chair of Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, Murray Sinclair. Many Indigenous peoples blame the residential boarding schools that have played a major role in the lives of generations in Canada for social problems such as alcoholism, domestic violence, and high suicide rates. Canadian politician Selina R. Kaysar, in her July 2021 interview with Mehr News Agency, said there is no doubt that residential schools were designed to eliminate Indigenous culture, not just for land, but also for the belief that their culture was inferior to that of the European settlers on the land. It is the entire foundation on which colonialism is built. The removal of native people from their land, source of energy and livelihood, for the perpetuation of the idea of white supremacy. The release of the horrifying story of the discovery of hundreds of mass graves in the grounds of old residential schools from which the bodies of Canadian Indigenous children were removed caused tension in this country claiming human rights and a dispute between the Canadian government and the Vatican. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has urged Pope Francis to visit Canada to apologize to Indigenous people for the Catholic Church's treatment of Aboriginal children in schools it ran there. In a visit to Canada, Pope Francis apologized to Canada's Indigenous communities for the Church's harmful legacy over residential schools. I ask forgiveness in particular for the ways in which many members of the Church and of religious communities cooperated, not least through their indifference in projects of cultural destruction and forced assimilation promoted by the governments of that time, which culminated in the system of residential schools, he said. In general, the recent discovery of unmarked graves at boarding schools in Canada is like a nightmare for many Indigenous Americans and Canadians that has never been forgotten. In the meantime, Tasnim News Agency reported the Iranian Foreign Ministry described the discovery of another mass grave of Indigenous children in Canada as a great human tragedy and a blatant example of the genocide in a country whose government resorts to hypocritical and deceptive shows to pretend support for human rights. In a statement released recently, Foreign Ministry spokesperson Nasser Kanani described as a major human tragedy and genocide the discovery of more mass graves of innocent Aboriginal children in Canada, as revealed in fresh reports. He said the refusal to present clear reports on the unearthing of these mass graves indicates the true extent of this human catastrophe and is a reminiscent of crimes committed during the UK-controlled white people's tyrannical and racist rule in Canada. These major and heinous crimes have been committed in a country whose government has, by putting on deceptive and hypocritical shows, always tried to create the impression that it is an advocate of human rights and express its opinion as an interventionist country about developments in other countries as if they were beholden to it, he explained. The Foreign Ministry's website reported. The spokesman said, "The Canadian government's slogans and claims are aimed at shifting the blame onto others and deflecting attention from its complicity in this human tragedy and bear testimony to the fact that this government and its allies are using human rights as a tool to impose their biased political viewpoints on others." Kanani expressed regret and deep concern over the large extent of these crimes and historic genocide while sympathizing with the Canadian Indigenous community, saying, "These crimes against humanity will never remain undisclosed to true justice seekers around the world, and the Canadian government should be held accountable for its dark past." An investigative team has found 66 more potential unmarked graves at a former residential school in British Columbia, the Williams Lake First Nation, WLFN, said at a press conference. The announcement of the discovery brings the number to 159 found at the former St. Joseph Mission Residential School. 93 were uncovered in May 2021.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.